Welcome to the Daily Wrap-Up, a concise show dedicated to bringing you the most relevant independent news as we see it from the last 24 hours.
March 3rd, 2019. Thank you for joining me yet again. I'm actually going to try to make this a little bit of a shorter show for you today, but there's always important stuff to get into that I have to cover for you guys. There's far too much going on today. I mean, Venezuela is far from over, as we're going to talk about a bit today, which we can all see. They're clearly going to be finding more reasons and more pretext and basically just creating the justification to go further into Venezuela, as they've been planning to. Syria is actually about to kick off yet again, in Idlib specifically, which will reveal yet again the U.S.'s desire and resolve to completely defend the extremist groups that are currently overwhelming that area. Israel is being exposed as, on the world stage, importantly, as the war crimes committing human rights violating government that it is. But the United Nations is not going to do anything about it. So it's not that the United Nations is saying it that makes it important. It's simply the fact that it's being pushed into the general sphere of discussion. And Corbyn in general is talking today about, or recently about, condemning them for what we do know about them, and that's important. And our own institutions and government entities are continually being revealed as the profiteering, malfeasant groups that they are. But that never stops the profiteering. The information comes out and things continue forward, which shows us that the system is broken. Not that people aren't aware of the problem, but the system is built around these problems to protect them. There's really never a shortage of breaking news to bring to your attention. So let's begin with a quick one I want to cover to begin with today that sets the tone for some of the other things we're going to get into. And I don't actually agree completely with the title here. I think this is a misrepresentation of, you know, Trump speaking off the cuff as he all too often does, entitled "Trump Admits Failure of U.S. Policies in Syria and Iraq," which I don't really think that's what he was doing. I mean, I think this is him talking about how the policies in general before him have been a problem and that where we are now is still a problem and he's doing his best to get out of it. But I would argue that's not what's happening at all. I think we are worse off than we were before in regard to how deep we are in our foreign policy, specifically with Iraq and Syria. Regardless of what they're saying about Syria, the problem is continuing. But there's important things that are said in this article that I want to touch on. Now, U.S. President Trump on Saturday criticized the past U.S. foreign policies in Iraq and Syria, saying that his administration will focus on fixing up America's infrastructure rather than fighting endless wars. Except the fact that that's exactly what they're continuing to do, which, interestingly, our first thing we're going to get into today is exactly about an endless war that's continuing. So it's just saying one thing and doing something else is exactly what politicians do. Narrative versus actions. And they continue to talk about not being the policemen of the world and not fighting endless wars and then double down and do the same thing. Right? We have Cuba and Nicaragua next slated in line for regime change. How is that not another endless war? How is that not being the policemen of the world? But they know this. The point is they're trying to propagandize those that are still willing to take it without questioning anything that they're saying. Now, during his two-hour speech, which I'm sure everyone's talking about today at the Conservative Political Action Conference, Donald Trump said that ISIS will be defeated 100%, you know, in a day or two, and reiterated his administration's firmness to pull American troops out of the area. It's funny how he had previously said that they were defeated. Now he's saying that they will be defeated in the near future. The point is they were never defeated. They're never going to be defeated, at least by the United States, because they don't plan to do that. They've never been planning to do that. And there's a mountain of evidence to suggest that this is something that they've created, fomented, and armed, and funded, and supported for a very long time. Now, the reality here, though, is that he's just saying this because that's what people want to hear. And he's saying that we're going to get there, but until then, we're going to maintain our presence there, which we know. Now, Trump said, quote, "We will leave a small group of guys and gals, but we want to bring our people back home. It is time." Except the fact that they've already admitted that they're not going back home. The vast majority are going right across the border to Iraq, and they're going to maintain their forceful presence against Syria. So a small fraction may be going home, and I even doubt that. But the reality is they're maintaining their presence, and they're going to be staying in Syria regardless. But it just shows you this setting the tone for continuing to create this narrative around these stories that are patently false, easily verifiably false. And speaking of endless wars, here's a perfect example of what we're talking about, what's happening right this moment in Venezuela. As John Bolton tweets, approximately 20,000 children under the age of one will have died in Venezuela due to the Maduro-made crisis, and another 808,000 children will be at nutritional risk. It is time to do what is right and allow aid into Venezuela. Before I even address the outrageous misrepresentations and lies, This is where I first saw this tweet. Whitney Webb shared it saying, "Spare us the crocodile tears. You have no credibility saying this and ignoring the well-documented famine in Yemen that you have helped to create." There's no ignoring one or the other of these stories. You can't criticize Maduro and pretend that we care about starving people while ignoring the worst humanitarian crisis in the world that the U.S. has created. It's absolutely staggering to me. But for what he's saying here, 20,000, first of all, the numbers come from, I would immediately question that these numbers are legitimate after all of the lies just in the last so many months that we've seen coming out of these very people. They're willing to outright lie to you to carry out this regime change. Again, that doesn't mean that everything's great in Venezuela, doesn't mean Maduro is a hero, but it means that John Bolton has been lying to you. And that is an absolute verifiable fact. So first off, questioning 20,808, I would question anything they have to say. But sir, let's just say for the sake of conversation, that's 100% accurate. That is a fraction of what's happening in Yemen right this moment that John Bolton is directly involved in. A fraction. And we're talking about children that are, you know, net nutritional risk. We're talking about millions of people in Yemen that are currently on the brink of starvation at this moment. This is from months ago. At that point, one child every 10 minutes died in Yemen due to U.S. and Saudi bombings, due to U.S. and Saudi blockades of their food and their medicine and bombing their water supplies. That is what we should be caring about. Well, both for that matter. But the reality that Bolton has the nerve to tweet something like this while making sure the media ignores what they're doing in Yemen shows you the true nature of these sociopaths. And shows you this has absolutely nothing to do with actually caring about the suffering of other people. Now, for the next part, as we continue to talk about, it is time to do what is right and allow aid into Venezuela. Allow aid into Venezuela, Bolton? Oh, you mean like the 933 tons that were sent in from a multitude of allies from around the world? Turkey, Russia, Cuba, China, on and on. Oh, what about the fact that the International Red Cross has increased its efforts in Venezuela well after the fact of all of this stuff you're saying? Or here's another one where Venezuela accepted a shipment of Russian humanitarian aid, and you can see the photos of it right there. And it's just another report about the Red Cross doubling its budget for helping Venezuela. Now, all of these things, mind you, are being right out in the open while the mainstream media and the U.S. government continue to tell you that nothing else is getting through. I mean, It really makes my head spin that it's that obvious to see, and they are really banking on the fact that you will either think that what that is or what I just showed you is all a big fabrication, which is possible, anything's possible, or that it's not happening at all, that they're literally not bringing anything else, that Maduro is bombing things and setting things on fire just to starve his people because he's a maniac murderer. And that's what they always want you to think. But the reality is we've seen tons and tons of aid getting through, and Bolton continues to tell you that, well, they're not letting anything through. And if we don't get our militarized, politicized aid, somebody actually brought this up the other day. The politicized part was from a quote from the United Nations. Red Cross, United Nations have said openly they're politicizing this, but the United Nations in a separate quote had said that politicizing and militarizing aid is not something we support. So just for those that want to research that, that's where the politicized and the militarized aspect come from the United Nations specifically talking about what the U.S. is trying to do here with their supposed aid. So this is clearly going to continue. And as we can see with the next article in regard to Guaido, that we know that they're setting this up for the next part. In my opinion, this is the prearranged, or at least hoping that Maduro will arrest Guaido, and that will be the next aspect that they use to force in what they're trying to do. Venezuela's Guaido to return home after Latin American tour with arrest looming. Now, the idea is that the Supreme Court of Venezuela had said that what he, for a lot, for basically during, on the, I believe it was January 23rd, when he self-proclaimed himself president, there was a ban on his travel that was brought down by the Supreme Court, and he just disregarded it and went to Colombia anyway. And I think that was intentional. I think they know, or rather they hope, that Maduro will arrest him so they can use this and make up all kinds of salacious lies about what's happening to him so they can rush in and do what they've been trying to do from the very beginning. But we can see this coming. This is clearly about to break off. Now, Venezuelan opposition leader and, of course, self-appointed president Juan Guaido said on Saturday he will return home in the next coming days after a visit to Ecuador and called for new protests, of course, next week against President Maduro, whose government has banned him from traveling abroad and who has been branded by, as Venezuela's illegitimate leader by a lot of different countries supporting the U.S. agenda, most of which are past victims of one of their regime change coups, except that they have massive support from a lot of other countries the mainstream media does not tell you about. And he says, quote, I announce my return to the country and I call on marches across the country for Monday and Tuesday. So that's tomorrow and the next day. He's calling for more violent protests, which every single one they've had so far has been quite violent, at least in regard to the propagandized efforts when the U.S. is involved. Now, he tweeted this on Saturday. He says, quote, we call on people to be attentive in the next steps that we'll announce, basically saying pay attention because there's more coming. Clearly, this is an ongoing effort to overthrow a government. Pretty simple. Now, Guaido secretly left Venezuela last month in violation of that travel ban. The Supreme Court had imposed this travel ban on him after he, you know, undemocratically declared himself interim president. He has spent the past few days touring between Latin American countries to muster support for his campaign to form a transition government and attempt to oust Maduro, whom he denounces as an illegitimate usurper, even though he was elected with the vast majority, whereas Guaido was not elected at all and appointed himself president. So who's actually the usurper here? I think they just use terms they think are going to be catchy. They don't maybe really even understand what usurper means in that context. Because even if you want to say Maduro was illegitimate, he didn't usurp anybody. Like, this is what's so funny is they use these pop words because they're trying to get it out and they want people to use these words about Maduro when it doesn't even really apply, even under their own deception. Right? It's just humorous to me. Now, Guaido said Venezuelans should again take to the streets on Monday and Tuesday, even though Venezuela right now, like a lot of other Latin American countries, is celebrating the carnival holiday. He said, quote, we have little to celebrate and a lot to do. So basically just calling people to forget about everything else you're doing, rush out into the streets and cause problems so we can blame it on Maduro. That's how I take it. Now, Guaido has called on the international backers to impose harsher measures, you know, to pressure Maduro. And of course, after the aid convoy's failure, forcing the idea that all options are on the table and keep all the options open, as they really make sure we hear that every single day. But the sad reality is that we're talking about Guaido, who they claim is the leader of the people, who's calling for more sanctions that will hurt the people. Can't misunderstand that. Now, Venezuela's female vice president, Delcy Rodriguez, said the Venezuelan government has already taken concrete legal steps to claim back the assets of which it was robbed, which it was, by the U.S. and which have been frozen by European banks, including blocking access to repatriating the Venezuela state gold currently held by the Bank of England. Like $7 billion, I believe, that they're just simply not allowing them to have. Now, the Venezuelan vice president also said that Caracas would mount a legal defense against the U.S. move to freeze the $7 billion of assets belonging to the state-owned PDVSA oil and natural gas giant and its U.S. subsidiary Citgo. Now, I may have been mistaken about the number of the gold. Either way, they're holding their billions of dollars of gold. And in this case, we're talking about $7 billion of assets belonging to their state-owned oil company that they're also not allowing them to have. Now, when discussing Guaido, Vice President Rodriguez said, quote, this person is not only making a joke of himself inside the country, but is now making a circus show at the international level. She blamed the U.S.-backed opposition leader of colluding with the Trump administration to overthrow Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, which is a pretty obvious thing to see. Well, you could argue he's doing it for good reasons because we're fighting for the democracy and the people. But he's literally, quite clearly, colluding with Trump to overthrow the Venezuelan government. It's exactly what they're doing. For good reasons, maybe, which I think we can all see, hopefully we can all see is not actually the case, but they're doing that. Now, meanwhile, the Trump administration has warned Caracas of serious consequences if it harms Guaido, who could face up to 30 years in prison, according to a judge of the country's Supreme Tribunal for Justice. But they claim that that's all illegitimate because that's all part of Maduro's government and nothing until Guaido gets put in place is legitimate, is what they're claiming. But the idea here, just like when they left their ambassadors and Maduro didn't take the bait, this is clearly an effort. And I mean, knowing that he would open this door, that's probably why they wanted him to leave on the 23rd. So he can now come back, make a big show of it, and get arrested. And the U.S., I promise you, if he does get arrested, will use that as a catalyst to make a next step, whether that's military intervention or just something further, who ultimately knows. But this is clearly where it's going. And we have to be aware of where the moral, the real justice in all of this comes from. That we're talking about a country that is forcing its will upon Venezuela just because of their ideological beliefs, and then trying to cover it all with humanitarianism and democracy and saving people, while all of that is very easy to show is a facade. Very easy. Not to mention the fact that we can talk about Weizenbrod and Alfred Zayas, the expert from the United Nations, and countless people showing us very clearly, you know, the very people you're supposed to ask, the experts, that U.S. sanctions are responsible for the problem. But we are all just supposed to ignore that because Maduro, bad guy. Yeah, that makes sense. But let's move on to some other stories about Syria that relate to U.S. foreign policy, as usual, in a lot of the vein of the discussions on this show. But something that I found very interesting in regard to the recent story we covered about the deal with the 50 tons of gold with ISIS in the United States, and the idea of countless examples of them releasing ISIS members back into the wild, leaders, high key members, and allowing them back in for different deals, and how all the next couple stories play right into that. At the very least, which I would say makes them complicit or responsible for some of this stuff. This coming from South Front, terrorists behead Syrian soldier captured during recent attack in northern Hama. Now, just this headline is smaller than something I would usually get into, one soldier, one attack. But there's more to this story that I found very relevant to all the things we're getting into. And it's about where these people came from and who they're connected with, and how that also ties in with Idlib, which we're going to get into in a moment. So terrorists behead Syrian soldier from the Syrian Arab Army during recent attack in northern Hama. Now, the terrorist group, Ansar al-Tawhid, beheaded a Syrian soldier who had been captured during a recent attack on the Syrian Arab Army positions in northern Hama countryside. Now, Ansar al-Tawhid was established in mid-2018 by Abu Daib Sarmin, a former prominent leader of ISIS-affiliated Jund al-Aqsa, which was dismantled in 2017. Now, according to Syrian opposition sources, Abu Daib regathered former fighters of Jund al-Aqsa in the new group under a secret agreement with none other than Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, the al-Nusra al-Qaeda affiliate that the U.S. is protecting in Idlib, with their leader, Abu Muhammad al-Julani. Interesting, finding the connection with these ongoing efforts in Syria right back to the groups the U.S. are connected to. Now, considering the recent reports about the U.S. allowing ISIS leaders and their key members to leave and regroup on numerous occasions over the last so many years, and the most recent deal for 50 tons of gold I just referenced, this would appear to be a direct effect of the U.S. allowing these members to rebuild. And it's ongoing protection of the extremists in Idlib that are working directly with these very groups. Now, following Ansar al-Tawhid's attack, Syrian pro-government sources reported that the SSA is preparing to launch a large-scale operation within the demilitarized zone around Idlib. Thank you for the super chat. The sources claim that the operation will begin very soon, which is the next article talking about what's about to take place in Idlib. And this is also from South Front, entitled Syrian Army Prepares for Operation Around Idlib, Sends Warning Messages to Civilians in the Area. But just to take a step back on that story, it's very interesting to think about the idea that we're still having terrorist attacks, people being beheaded. The Syrian army, which they won't care about because all Syrians bad guy under the current U.S. policy. But the idea, I mean, what's even more frustrating now that I think about it is the Al-Rubkan, I believe that's what the name was before I mispronounce it. But the camp currently, I just wanted to say it right before I move forward. But the Al-Rubkan camp, where they're currently keeping Syrians against their will, where they're currently keeping a massive, like think about 45,000 Syrians against their will in an area where they're starving and have no clean water and on, and both Russia and Syria have tried to take them out and they won't allow them to. This is how they're using Syrians for their own manipulations. This is not what good people do. This is not what the good guys do. And this is not a knock on the United States. It's a knock on the government that has taken control of this and is doing absolutely nothing that Americans truly want. But it's just sad to see this. But so now we're talking about other members connected with Hayat Tahrir al-Sham that are decapitating members of the Syrian army that are connected back to these groups that they've allowed to release. And I find this very, very revealing. Now for this next one, Syrian army prepares for operation in Idlib. It's something we've known has been coming. And I promise you, when they try to do this, the U.S. is going to stick its hand back in. And I think this will be used for the catalyst to stay more in Syria, just like we saw last time. And interestingly enough, the most powerful part of this is that they sent a message to civilians in the area, something the U.S. media would never report on, something they will continue to tell you is the opposite of the reality, that Assad is just drooling at the prospect of gassing his own people yet again. But the reality is he's warning all the civilians, saying you guys need to get out of the area because we're about to officially take this area back. Really sounds what a maniac would do, right? But this is going to be a big story as it develops, and it's something I wanted to get ahead of because we've seen it coming. And that also includes the potential for false flag gas attacks, which we have been seeing build up. Now, the Syrian Arab Army has officially begun its final preparations to launch a large-scale military operation around the northern governorate of Idlib, which is controlled by several radical groups, according to the Syrian news outlet Marazalan, citing a military source. Now, the terrorist groups, it says, quote, crossed the red line recently by killing many civilians, injuring others, and causing severe damage in the infrastructure. This is a clear violation of the Sochi agreement between Russia and Turkey. Now, according to the source, the operation will be aimed at capturing the militants' positions inside the demilitarized zone around Idlib. Now, this Hayat Tahrir al-Sham is predominantly the group we're talking about here. Now, a few hours after this report, Syrian opposition activists said that the remaining civilians within the demilitarized zone received a message from the Syrian Arab Army asking them to leave the zone immediately. Now, there's images of this within the article you can look at for yourself. And it said, quote, you are in a special operation area. Leave the area immediately. Warning the civilians, there's things are about to happen here. And this is just not something you would expect to happen from, you know, the maniacal leader that wants to kill his own people. Now, in the last 2 months, the SSA massed large forces around the demilitarized zone. However, many sources have just said that the army was just reinforcing its position there. But the claims about a nearing military operation around Idlib came just hours after the attack by the Al-Qaeda-affiliated group we were just speaking about, Ansar al-Tahid, on the Syrian Arab Army positions in northern Hama. So after they carried out this attack is when this, as they said, screw it, we need to go back in and get this out of the way. This little pocket of extremists the U.S. is allowing to maintain within Syria needs to go away. Now, more than 16 Syrian service members were reportedly killed in the attack by the Al-Qaeda-affiliated group. Again, the Al-Qaeda group, we're talking, you know, the ones that they're working with in Idlib, the ones they're working with in Yemen, same old groups, affiliated rather. Now, in other news, in regard to why the U.S. is even in Syria and why they now have, you know, committed to staying, and that's, of course, to protect Israel, oh, and to, you know, combat Iran. And the double standard is clear when it comes to U.S. allies in general. For this next story coming from Anti-Media in regard to Jeremy Corbyn, entitled Jeremy Corbyn Calls for the U.K. to Condemn Israel's Killing of Palestinians. Of course, we all know the stories of Jeremy Corbyn being called an anti-Semite just because he's pointing out the reality of the situation in regard to Israel, something that is now breaking through. But yet he'll still be called an anti-Semite because that is what they do. That is their plan. That is their effort to diminish the calls of people that say, look at the crimes Israel's committing. But of course, you're anti-Semite if you just point out the crimes of Israel. It's like saying, look at what the U.S. just did in Syria. Oh, you're an anti-Christian. Doesn't work. But that's what they're doing. But this is an important story because this is something that has been growing. People are beginning to pay attention. And now he's using what the recent UN report and saying, look, this is, we all can see what's happening. They need to be condemned for their actions. Now, the head of the British Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, is calling for the UK government to condemn Israel's killing of Palestinians, as well as to freeze arms sales to the occupation state. Pretty simple. Nothing about Jewish people, nothing about anti-Semitism, simply saying that, look, this government is killing these people. And that's very easy to see. The UN's own report just said that they are intentionally killing children and journalists. We just reported on it. And because of this obvious war crime acts and these human rights violations, we need to freeze arms sales. It's very simple. But people don't want this to be the case because Israel is very powerful and has influence in all of these governments. Now, his remarks came in the wake of a UN report, which I covered, that found that Israel, that, you know, and the funny thing about the report is they've done this more than once. They said, might have committed war crimes. Like, here's all the evidence of the children and journalists and doctors they killed. And we think they might have committed war crimes. It just shows you the absurd nature of the United Nations and the ruling factions of that organization. But the reality is that it's just another opportunity to get this in front of the people that have never seen it before and go, wow, they are killing journalists and children. And yeah, it's all right there. But because of this report, he's now trying to jump on this and make what should happen, which is the international community having the courage, the gumption to stand up and say, you guys are a criminal organization. What your government organization, not the entirety of Israel, but what this government is doing is a very bad. I mean, when you understand that they're allowed to get away with this stuff, what this does to a certain degree is allow smaller nations that actually really want to carry these things out. It gives them the not necessarily the power, but the drive to do so, because they say, look, Israel can get away with this. And here's the line I have to use to be able to get away with it. We'll just say Iran's there. We'll just say that they're all terrorists. Hey, we can get away with it. Same thing that U.S. is doing. Now on Twitter, Corbyn wrote, quote, the UN says Israel's killing of demonstrators in Gaza, including children, paramedics, and journalists, may constitute war crimes or crimes against humanity. The UK government must unequivocally condemn the killing and freeze arms sales to Israel. Now, the UN report published earlier this week said, quote, the Israeli security forces killed and maimed Palestinian demonstrators who did not pose an imminent threat of death or serious injury to others when they were shot, nor were they directly participating in hostilities. Adding that the protests had been civilian in nature. Pretty damn simple. Thousands and thousands of people, unarmed people in the process of 9 months that have been shot on record, unarmed, verified. That's a crime. And it's time that they paid for it and are held accountable. And moving on to the final story of the day, this is something that really close to my heart, something I've covered for a long time, that I've written about for years, that people are paying attention to today. But the problem is that things are coming out here and there that no one's paying attention to. The information showing us these people need to be in jail for what they did, and they just get fines and get slapped on the wrist because they're part of the ruling class. This from ProPublica, entitled Sackler Embraced Plan to Conceal OxyContin Strength from Doctors' Sealed Testimony Shows. Thank you for the super chat, Wise. But so, you know, let's take this back to home for a minute in regard to the opioid crisis, because this is clearly a very important topic that they pretend to care about. Oh, we all need to care about the opioid crisis. We all need to care about what's really going on. We need to fight against MS-13 and the southern border. But that's not what this has to do with. We can see what's driving this problem. We can see the information that's come out from the whistleblowers, from the FDA, from the CDC, from Big Pharma themselves, showing us that they knew this, they pushed it forward, they hid it from us, and they profited from it, and now they're profiting from the other side of it. Here's some stuff to stop an overdose. Here's some stuff to fight your addiction. And they knew it, and they planned it all. And this is all on record from lawsuits, and no one is going to jail. It just has to show you the real problem that goes much larger than just Big Pharma. But the problem is that the system is broken if you've got enough money to fight your way out of it. Now, in May 1997, the year after Purdue Pharma launched OxyContin, its head of sales and marketing sought input on a key decision from Dr. Richard Sackler, a member of the billionaire family that founded and controls the company. Now, Michael Friedman, head of sales and marketing, told Sackler that he didn't want to correct the false impression among doctors that OxyContin was weaker than morphine because the myth was boosting prescriptions and sales. He said, quote, it would be extremely dangerous at this time. And this is from an email from sealed testimony that was released that came out a long time ago, and we're only just now seeing it. It says, it'd be extremely dangerous at this early stage in the life of the product, he wrote to Sackler, to make physicians think the drug is stronger or equal to morphine. Thank you for the super chat, Gary. It says, we are well aware of the view held by many physicians that oxycodone, the active ingredient in OxyContin, is weaker than morphine. I do not plan to do anything about that, he says. And then Sackler responds, I agree with you. Is there a general agreement or are there some holdouts? Now, 10 years later, Purdue pleaded guilty in federal court to understating the risk of addiction to OxyContin. And understating is a generous word. They're lying or omitting something that allowed a lot of people to die. Now, that word drives me crazy. And this, of course, coming from groups that want this to be seen a certain way in a lot of ways. But they claim they understated the risk of addiction to OxyContin, including failing to alert doctors that it was stronger painkiller than morphine, and agreed to pay, you know, $600 million in fines and penalties. Really? Thank you for super chats, everyone. I appreciate all your support. But this is, we're talking about a group that willfully lied to doctors, to patients, to the government, and allowed this to happen. and then hid it as it was happening, lied again as they got asked about it, and allowed tens of thousands of people a year to die. And there's like, here's, and they made billions of dollars, and there's a $600 million fine. Meh. What do you got in your wallet? Let's just call it even. That's what we're talking about here. This is how broken the system is. That if you've got the money, you don't get held accountable. The two-tier justice system we're always talking about. This is the problem. And it goes so far beyond the big pharma, so far beyond anything we're talking about. It is an all-encompassing problem. Now this, while we're hearing all this information that we constantly talk about, and this is not the first time we've talked about the reality of their lies and how they've been exposed for, the biggest one I thought was where they, in their own documentation, showed that they knew that there was a big problem, they hid the problem, and then said, look, we can profit wildly off the treating of addiction, so let's keep this going. That's also in the lawsuit that they talk about. Well, while all this is ongoing, guess what? American opioid deaths have quadrupled in 18 years. And thanks for your $600 million that I'm sure went to help the families of these people that died. I have no doubt. Or more likely went in the pockets of the politicians that made it happen. But, you know, whatever. 18 years quadrupled the deaths. Now, this crisis was so hard-hitting in just 2016 that Americans' life expectancy as a whole declined by 0.36 of a year. Just in that one year because of the opioid crisis. About 70,000 Americans died from drug overdoses just in 2017, which is a new national record. And this is the frustrating part about all of this, the most frustrating part, is that the government and some major corporations were directly involved with not just creating this epidemic, but knowingly allowing it to continue, and it's not even a secret. We all know if you care to pay attention, it's all right there in front of you. The lawsuit Massachusetts is suing the Sackler family, it's all coming out. But ask yourself, why no one's in jail? Why has no one been held accountable? Why are the government organizations involved with this that look the other way, such as the FDA, not getting held accountable? It should upset all of you. It really should. Here's another great article from Natural Blaze. CBS 60 Minutes asks if FDA ignited the opioid crisis. Big Pharma exec says, yes. Yes, they did, of course, because we know they did. Ed Thompson, a drug manufacturer, spent decades managing and producing opioids for Big Pharma, spoke with them, 60 Minutes, and openly said, yes, they are responsible. They did this. They held secret meetings between Purdue Pharma and the FDA starting in 2001 to coordinate this effort. They manipulated the labeling of the bottles to allow the term long-term use to be accepted, knowing that they shouldn't be using it for long-term use, which of course afterward tripled their profits. Yeah, no big deal. He pointed out how they have no studies on long-term safety use, or that scientific evidence for the FDA that they should be relying on in regard to these topics is simply non-existent. All out there, right? This is from people directly involved with what we're talking about. It's very sad. And as one author correctly pointed out, record drug overdoses, you know, they tend not to occur in the greatest economy ever, but instead economic recession and depressions. Should really make you think about where we might actually be economically, and they really, really don't want us to know. Now, do we really believe that a government that cares so little about the health and safety of its own people truly cares about the safety and well-being of the people of another nation? I mean, only so far as that feigned concern can garner the desired objective, after which those suffering civilians get to actually find out what suffering looks like, as they are left to fend for themselves in the lawless wasteland their country has become after the promised U.S. liberation, which we've seen all too many times. Now, those who think saying such things is un-American seem to have forgotten what that term means, as I find it un-American to commit genocide, to rob a nation of its resources and identity, to steal away its sovereignty, all while pretending to fight for human rights and democracy. That's un-American. Anyone who would willfully ignore the death and destruction of innocents just because the acts were carried out or allowed by those we're supposed to be holding to account as our leaders no longer understands what it means to be an American. More importantly, no longer understands what it means to be a member of the human race, which is how we need to begin seeing the world if we truly want to move past this tribalist mentality and discover what we're capable of. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I appreciate you being here. Make sure you spread this information out to everybody you know to help wake people up to what's really going on. And if you want to support this channel, there's numerous ways you can do so in the show notes below, from buying a Question Everything t-shirt, supporting us on PayPal or Patreon or Bitbacker, or simply just being here and participating, which is what really matters to me the most. As always, I love you all. Question everything. Come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant.